My name is Adrian Mariner, survey scout, 12 years experience. I was the leader of a survey team sent to discover what happened on Shannon's world. They didn't tell us about the earlier teams, the ones that didn't come back. There were 10 of us, good men and women. They're all dead now. I am the only survivor. There's a war going on down there. The pleasure world, it's a nightmare now. Every man, woman, and child who came here died horribly. But the war goes on. It always will. Don't send any more teams. What's down there is too much for any human to stand.
Flynn shut off his camera, and the face disappeared from the view screen, replaced by the enigmatic face of Hazel Dama, coming up to meet them.
That's pretty much it, I'm afraid. He just says the same thing over and over, when he can stop himself crying or screaming. It's as though what he saw horrified him so much that his mind became stuck in a groove, forever repeating itself. He died soon after this tape was made, and it was probably a blessing. He was quite insistent that every human being on a planet is dead, which rather begs the question, who's fighting this endless war he talked about? People have come up with various answers, none of them conducive to a good night's sleep. If anyone has any helpful comments, feel free to chip in. I've watched this tape till it's coming out of my ears, and it still scares the crap out of me. I mean, this was an experienced survey scout, seen everything. And Herr Keldemer reduced him to a sobbing child.
I've seen the tape before. I knew one of the people involved in his original debriefing. We have no idea why Mariner survived when the rest of his team died, or how he got off-planet. The quarantine star cruiser was adamant that no ship had got past it. Mariner was discovered wandering the streets of Golgotha's main starport, crying his eyes out and telling his story to anyone who'd listen. Security picked him up, but they never did find his ship, or figure out how he managed to land it on Golgotha without setting off all kinds of alarms. Which is, of course, yet another thing that's supposed to be impossible.
For any number of reasons. How could he have guided a ship all the way from here to Golgotha all on his own? Computers can only do so much. Someone must have been with him. Someone must have helped him.
If they did, they never surfaced, despite an awful lot of people looking for them really hard. The Empress was breathing fire over the lapse in security, and she was not at all happy when the search came up empty-handed. She takes homeworld security very seriously. I did hear there were a lot of sudden vacancies in security's upper echelons not long after that.
Julian bit his lower lip hard. He could feel the familiar debilitating ache building in his head again. He couldn't give in to it now. He couldn't be seen to be weak. Not now. He hugged himself tightly and made himself breathe deep and slow. It didn't help much, it never did, but he had to do something. To distract himself, he leaned forward and concentrated on the sensor panels. He could feel cold sweat beating on his forehead. He hoped the others hadn't noticed.
I thought Harker had a personal beacon.
He did, but not long after he got here, he took it off and left it with the crash-landed ship. We don't know why. He could be anywhere by now.
He could even be dead.
Think positively. At least we're getting a clear signal from the beacon. Hopefully his ship will provide clues as to where to look next.
Put us down right next to the ship, Campbell, and let us all pray that the trail isn't as cold as seems likely. Or we could be here for a long time.
Finley put the adapted cargo ship down on a great grassy plain, only a few hundred yards away from the remains of the crash-landed escape pod. The pod looked in rough shape, but the beacon came through loud and clear. There was no sign of life anywhere. Finley was quickly out the hatch to stand beside the Deathstalker, with Toby and Flynn hot on his heels. They moved slowly toward the pod, checking all the time for hidden booby traps. Evangeline and Julian were left behind to guard the cargo ship and keep things ready for an emergency takeoff should one prove necessary. Uneasy in each other's company, they studied their surroundings a little more intently than they really needed to. According to the view screen and sensors, the grassy plain stretched away to the horizon in all directions. A vivid green so pure and unwavering, it was almost unnatural. There was no sign of any life. No birds, no insects. The scene was completely silent, save for the quiet steps of the new arrivals approaching the pod. The sky was a brilliant blue, sharp and clear, with no trace of any cloud. It was a warm and comforting sky, almost hypnotic, the kind you could lie under for hours and never wonder where the time went. High up in the sky, the fat yellow sun had a big, smiley face on it. Julian found that particularly disturbing. It made him feel like he was trapped inside a nursery school party.
How the hell did they do that?
Julian said finally, as much for the comfort of hearing his own voice as anything. The quiet was getting to him.
It's not that difficult. Some form of holographic projection, I expect. The real question is why anyone would want to.
Well, part of Shannon's dream, I suppose.
Julian's headache was wearing off, and he was feeling human again.
Smell the air coming in through the hatch. Pure and rich and invigorating. Designer air. That's the kind of attention to detail that pulls in the visitors.
It's all right, I suppose, if you like it pastoral. But why is it so quiet? Where is everybody? Is this all there is?
Julian smiled slightly for the first time.
I very much doubt it. I can't see Shannon getting away with charging top prices just for this.
I don't know. After the pressures and hurly-burly of high society, I can see some people paying a good price for guaranteed peace and quiet.
I wouldn't give you a bent penny for this. It's as though something is waiting to happen. Something bad. I'm going to try a psionic scan. See if I can pick up anything.
Is that wise? The doctors did say you were still supposed to be taking things easy.
I can pull my weight. If I thought otherwise, I wouldn't be here.
He knew he shouldn't be doing this, but he had something to prove, if only to himself. Julian concentrated, his mind leaping up and out, searching for life signs and hidden surprises. The rest of his team blazed brightly around him, warm and comforting in their humanness. The crash-landed pod was dark and empty, all systems down, though the beacon shrilled endlessly. He stretched out, covering the grassy plains. His range was limited compared to what it had been before the mind techs got their hands on him, but he pushed those limits as hard as he could. Suddenly, he made contact. Two of them, just on the other side of the horizon, heading toward him. But he was damned if he could tell what they were. They were quite definitely alive, their minds shining bright and clear, but they were like nothing he'd ever encountered before. Intelligent, focused, but not human. Julian pulled back, alarmed on an almost instinctual level, and his mind suddenly jarred on something else, so close at hand he'd overlooked it before. The shock jolted him back into his body, and his head fell forward into his hands as he groaned aloud. Evangeline moved quickly in beside him.
What is it? What did you see?
We're not alone here. There's another ship about 20 feet away, buried under the grass. It's full of death. Tell the others.
In the end, it took all of them working together the best part of an hour to dig down to the buried ship's airlock. The lock was closed, its power depleted, and they had to crank it open with the exterior manual override. Inside, it was dark and gloomy, all systems dead, and they had to wait impatiently while Finley went back to the cargo ship for flashlights. None of them felt like going in without them. Julian was still muttering about death. They moved slowly through the dark interior, the ship gradually giving up its secrets to the bobbing lights. It was an Imperial pinnace, presumably sent down from the orbiting star cruiser. Something had shot the shit out of it, but it had still made a safe landing. The rebels searched the pinnace from stem to stern, but there was no sign of life anywhere. What they did find was blood. Old, dried blood. Dark and heavy, and splashed over most of the interior. Given that the inner hull was still intact, despite the battering the pinnace had taken, it seemed clear that whatever happened did so after the landing.
These bloodstains are long dry. Whatever went down here, it's over. Guess the war must still be going on.
Finley unloaded the memory crystal containing the pinnace's log, took it back to the cargo ship, and ran the last few entries on the view screen. Everyone crowded together before the screen, but the log didn't have much to tell them. The pinnace had been sent down by the quarantined star cruiser, the Deliverance. It had carried a crew of 20, all trained Marine elite reconnaissance troops. They'd tracked Harker's beacon to the escape pod and put down beside it. There were no more log entries after that.
They had the same idea we had. And look what happened to them.
We don't know what happened to them yet. We don't know what happened to anyone yet.
None of this makes sense. If the recon team were all killed, where are their bodies? And why bury the ship instead of them?
According to our sensors, there's some kind of building or structure just over the horizon, due east of here. I say we go and take a look. Maybe we'll find some answers there. Or at least some clues.
What about the two contacts I made? There were definitely some kind of life form heading this way.
If you see anything that isn't us or Harker, you have my permission to shoot first and ask questions afterward, if at all. The one thing we can be sure of is that we don't have any friends here. This particular part of Haseldama may seem quiet and harmless, but that doesn't mean you can trust it an inch. Stay alert, all of you. This place kills people.
And so they set off across the grassy plain, under a sun, with a smiley face. The horizon slowly flattened out before them, eventually revealing a sudden dip in the land, like a huge grassy crater. In the middle of this was a large building, simple and blocky, constructed in bright primary colors. A high arch stood between the rebels and the building, covered in swirling red and white stripes. A large sign at the top of the arch said, "Welcome to Summerland." There were floodlights at the top of the sign, but they'd all been smashed. There were splashes of old, long-dried blood on the arch supports. Beyond the arch, the building had its own cheerful sign saying, "Welcome Station." Giles headed toward it, gun in hand, and the others followed him. The rebels moved slowly forward, checking every corner and shadow for potential enemies. They all had their guns in their hands now, except for Toby and Flynn, who were getting it all on film. The eerie silence hung about them like a shroud as they entered the station and searched from room to room. The wooden furniture had been broken apart and the pieces tossed aside, like so much kindling. There were children's paintings on the walls, damaged by smoke and heat, and curling at the edges. Some were splashed with blood. More unusual were oversized children's toys, overturned here and there, like a rocking horse large enough for a grown man to ride. As they pressed deeper into the welcome station, the rebels found themselves stepping over more toys left scattered on the floor, as though their owners had been interrupted in their play, or had had to leave in a hurry. They were in the heart of the building now, the gymnasium, lit brightly by sunlight streaming through the shattered windows, illuminating vaulting horses and other simple equipment, most of it wrecked or overturned. And there, at the back of the room, on a row of wooden stakes hammered into the floor, were impaled 20 severed human heads. There was no sign of the bodies anywhere, or even that much blood. The shrunken, mummified faces stared back at the rebels with empty eye sockets. Their mouths dropped in silent, eternal screams. Toby gestured to Flynn, who nodded, and sent his camera forward for a close-up, panning slowly along the row of screaming faces.
"You bastards! You bloody vultures! Haven't you any feelings? Is that all you can think of, getting good pictures for your ghoulish audience? Doesn't this move you at all?"
"Sure. That's why we're getting a record of each face, so they can be identified by their next of kin."
"Oh. Sorry."
"And because it's a dynamite shot, it'll make a hell of an impact on the early morning news slots. This is the kind of footage that wins awards."
"Not to mention bonuses."
Julian didn't know what to say to that, so he looked to Finley for his cue. The Campbell was looking at the severed heads, but not seeing them, his brows furrowed as he tried to remember something. Evangeline put a hand on his arm.
"What is it, Finley?"
I know this place. Summerland. Someone told me about it long ago. This wasn't just a pleasure planet.
What else was it?
I'm not sure, but I think it was a therapy world.
There's someone outside. Two life forms. Not human. Definitely not human. But, sort of human. I've never sensed anything like it. They're waiting for us to come out. They don't feel threatening.
Then let's go talk with them, and let's hope they have some answers, because I'm not in the mood for any more mysteries. I just want something I can hit.
They moved quickly. When they reached the main entrance, they stumbled to a halt at the sight of what they found waiting for them there. Standing calmly before the entrance was a 4-foot-tall teddy bear with golden honey fur and dark, knowing eyes. He wore a bright red tunic and trousers and a long, bright blue scarf around his neck. He looked warm and lovable and entirely trustworthy. His companion didn't inspire the same kind of immediate trust. Well over 6 feet tall and wrapped in a long, filthy trench coat, he looked human enough, apart from the cloven feet, clawed hands, and large blocky goat's head, with long curling horns and a permanently nasty smile. His gray fur was soiled and matted where it showed, and his eyes had a dangerous wildness to them. He stood slouching before the rebels, half the buttons missing from his trench coat, his ears drooping as though he couldn't be bothered with them. Julian felt like shooting the goat thing on sight, but somehow couldn't bring himself to do it. There was something about the goat and the bear. The bear? Julian pushed his way forward, looking from the bear to the goat, and back again.
I know you. You're Bruin Bear and the Sea Goat. Every child's friend and hero.
Yeah,
said Flynn, pushing forward to stand beside him, his eyes fixed on the bear.
I used to have all your adventures. There were books and cartoons and films and interactive games, all to do with your adventures in the Golden Lands. I remember...
Yeah, well, we've been around for a while,
said the Sea Goat.
Not that we ever saw any royalties, mind you. That's what happens when you're not real, and you can't afford a decent lawyer.
You're automatons. Mechanical devices with pre-programmed minds in the shapes of well-loved children's characters.
Nah, we're just toys. We're all toys here.
Welcome to Summerland,
said Bruin Bear.
Or what's left of it. We're here to look after you.
Giles looked at the others.
You know these characters? Hell, they were classics even in my day. If they're still popular, maybe the Empire isn't as far gone as I thought.
We're hard to get rid of. Come on, Bear. Let's get this bunch moving. It'll be evening soon, and things are always worse once it starts getting dark.
Hold everything. No one's going anywhere until we've got some answers. Starting with who the hell killed those Marines and stuck their heads on sticks.
It was the bad toys. The bad toys killed everyone here. By now they must know you're here and they'll be coming to kill you too. Please come with us. We'll take you somewhere safe and explain along the way.
He smiled at them winningly, and they all had some kind of smile in return. He was that kind of bear. And because he was Bruin Bear, that most trustworthy of animals, the rebels looked at each other, nodded, more or less in unison, and followed the bear up the grassy slope, away from the wrecked welcome station. The Sea Goat stayed at the rear, grumbling to himself and looking around him with wild, staring eyes, as though he expected an attack at any moment. Even though they could all see for miles across the open grassy plains, and there was no living thing in sight. Bruin Bear led the way, doing his best to remain cheerful, as he calmly and evenly unfolded a tale that grew steadily darker and more disturbing. And for all its strangeness and terrors, the rebels believed every word. In the beginning, there was Shannon's world and Summerland. Shannon's newly terraformed planet had been designed from top to bottom to be calm and peaceful, and everyone's idea of heaven. Or to be exact, every child's vision of heaven. There was no echo structure, no native life, nothing to get in the way of Summerland. A place where there were no demands, no duties, no necessary boring tasks. Just Summerland, and the toys that live there. Intricate automatons following simple programs, based on familiar and much-loved fictional creations, from the oldest and most traditional to the very latest fads. There were no human staff in Summerland, only the toys. The toys had orders to prevent bad behavior, and if necessary, remove any persistent troublemakers so that the illusion might not be unduly shattered, but they were rarely called upon to act. And then came the rogue AIs from Shub. A dozen Furies, metal attack robots in human skins, through which the AIs spoke and acted. The Furies seized a dozen toys at random, took them inside their inhuman ship, and upgraded their intelligence, turning them from simple pre-programmed servants into fully fledged, independent AIs. The newly conscious toys went back into Summerland, and the change spread like a virus, leaping from toy to toy, till every automaton on the planet was awake and aware, and truly alive for the first time. A new generation of rogue AIs in the bodies of toys. But with the change came new Shub programming. With intelligence came a built-in command to attack and destroy humankind, to wage war with humanity until no living thing of flesh and blood remained on Shannon's world. To make a bloodbath of Summerland. Some toys fell in love with the superior qualities of the Furies and happily slaughtered humans while singing songs of praise to Shub. Other toys found first resentment and then hatred in their roles as servants or slaves to humanity and rose up against their masters, determined to be free no matter what the cost. Some toys gloried in murder, while others fought with cold, implacable logic. And some just did what they were told by their new programming and would not think of the consequences. The toys fell upon the human guests with fury-given strength and tore them limb from limb, blood staining furry paws and stitched cloth limbs. There were screams of horror and panic as much-loved and trusted figures slaughtered men and women and laughed while they did it. The humans tried to fight, but they had no weapons and were greatly outnumbered. They tried to flee, but there was nowhere to run. The Furies controlled the only landing pads and had destroyed the few human ships waiting there. People tried to hide, but the toys always found them and dragged them out into the open so that their deaths could be enjoyed by all. But not all the toys went rogue. Some still remembered their original character and simply became more real versions of what they had always been. Created to play the part of humanity's friends and defenders, they broke from Shub's programming and took up their roles in reality. And some, now that they were free, refused to obey any orders, even Shub's, and went their own way. All too soon, all the humans on Shannon's world were dead. The rogue AIs on Shub looked on their work and were pleased. The toys warred with each other then, good toy against bad, an endless struggle fueled by rage and hatred and unadmitted guilt. The Furies watched, somewhat disconcerted. This was not what had been planned. It had been expected that they would supply the toys with Shub ships, and they would then leave Shannon's world to attack humanity's other worlds. Shub's new terror weapon, death and horror, made from humankind's own most loved creations. By now, the toys were split in two. Those determined to wipe out all humanity, and the toys who saw humanity as their parents and creators. One side fought to leave the planet and spread its death and terror among humanity, and the other side fought to stop them and protect humanity. The Furies eventually left. They had other work to do, and were not unhappy with what they had achieved. And so Shannon's world became Isildama, the Field of Blood.
The war goes on.
Bruin Bear led the rebel party across the wide grassy plain.
The bad toys greatly outnumber the good, but as long as we keep them from leaving this world, we're winning. Few humans come here now, and most of them die quickly. Some even kill themselves when they see the awful thing Shub has done. That's why the goat and I came to meet you, so you could see that not all the toys had forsaken you.
And to try and get you to what passes for safety here before the bad toys turned up and showed you what your own insides looked like.
Where exactly are you taking us?
Julian was rubbing at his forehead in a slow, bothered way.
We're going to Toys Town. You'll be safe there. If anywhere can be said to be safe now in Summerland.
They all paused at the top of a ridge and looked down. In the bottom of a valley, a brightly colored, steam-driven, child-sized train and carriages was waiting for them. The train was scarlet and black, with a big, happy face on the front, puffing steam from his funnel in a cheerful sort of way. The open carriages were all different colors, bright and shining, none of them more than 8 feet long, the seats just big enough to take 4 people. Gleaming silver railway tracks stretched away into the distance. The train looked up at the party on the ridge, winked one great eye, and tooted welcomingly. Bruin Bear waved a paw in return. Finley opened his mouth 2 or 3 times, and then shook his head firmly.
Forget it. I am not going anywhere on that. I'd rather walk. Hell, I'd rather crawl. I have my dignity to think of. I have a hard-won reputation as a cold-blooded assassin and a desperate warrior. One glimpse of me in Toby's film, perched in one of those kiddie carriages with my knees up in my face, and no one will ever take me seriously again.
Bruin Bear scratched his furry head.
I'm afraid this is the only means of transport available. There was a yellow brick road once, but it was destroyed in the war. Besides, it never really went anywhere. It was just for show. These days, the smaller toys sometimes beg rides on the larger ones, but mostly we just walk. There are the aeroplanes, of course, but they never come down anymore. They don't fight, they just fly. Forever, in the sky, high above the world, far from the war and its troubles. Only the railway remains in use, and even that isn't sacrosanct. Both sides have been known to dig up the rails when there's an advantage to be gained. The way should be clear now, but I can't vouch for how long. So I really do recommend we leave. Now.
Move your ass, or I'll molt on you.
Finley glared at Toby and Flynn.
This particular part of our journey had better be very carefully edited, or I will personally edit both of you with a blunt hacksaw.
Toby looked at Flynn.
I think he means it.
Flynn nodded solemnly. The bear led them down the grassy verge to the railway tracks and helped the rebels settle themselves into the undersized carriages. The train was called Edwin. He chattered happily away about nothing in particular until the passengers were in place, and then he tooted his whistle several times and set off down the tracks.
Woo-hoo! Good to be carrying passengers again! I mean, what use is a train unless he's carrying people somewhere? The other toys are very good, and let me take them for short rides now and again, when they can spare the time. But it's not the same. They don't care where they're going, and they're not people. I need to be doing something, something useful. I was designed to be of use, to fulfill a function, not just sit around thinking, which is overrated in my opinion. Thinking just gets in the way of a regular service. I chuff, therefore I am. And that's all I need to be happy.
It was a bumping, banging ride, even though Edwin couldn't build up much speed, and the carriages lurched back and forth as though they were at sea. He kept his speed at a constant 20, and after a while the rebels became somewhat accustomed to the lurching motion of the carriages. The rebels and the toys maintained a polite silence, each deep in his own thoughts. Finley suddenly remembered something he'd been meaning to ask, and leaned forward so his face was opposite the bear's.
Who buried the recon team's pinnace, and why?
We did, the goat and I. We arrived too late to save the humans, but we were able to drive the bad toys off before they could get to the ship. We wrecked the ship's engines and then buried it to put it out of temptation's way. The bad toys are desperate to get off-world, you see, and take their war to humanity. I'd like to have buried, or at least concealed, your ship. But there wasn't time. We can always do it later.
Don't worry. There are all kinds of unpleasant booby traps waiting for anyone who doesn't have the right warm-up codes.
Bruin Bear shook his head admiringly.
You humans, so tricky. But I wouldn't be too confident. Some toys have learned to be tricky, too.
Bruin Bear didn't seem to have anything to add to that, so Finley sat back in his seat. Somehow, Julian had managed to get the seat next to him rather than Evangeline, and the young Esper leaned over and murmured urgently in Finley's ear.
Pardon me for being paranoid, but aren't we being just a tiny bit too trusting here, Finley? I mean, how do we know these are the good guys? Just because they say so and look cuddly?
No, I don't think so. Bruin Bear wouldn't do that. If he wanted us dead, he and the goat have had plenty of opportunities. All they've done so far is talk and smile us to death. Besides, if you can't trust Bruin Bear, who can you trust?
I am glad to see humans again. I missed you terribly. You were always so happy when I took you places, laughing and shouting and pointing at things. You were all so happy then.
And then they all rocked in their seats as Edwin cut his speed suddenly, slowing almost to a crawl. All the humans looked ahead, but couldn't see anything. Bruin Bear stood up in his seat and stared ahead, one paw shading his eyes.
What is it, Edwin?
The tracks are out. Some way ahead. Someone's dug them up again.
I can't see anything.
Our eyes were designed to be more than human. We can see for miles.
I can see it. It doesn't look too bad. Can we repair it?
Oh, sure. I always carry spares these days, just in case. With you humans to help, we should be finished inside an hour.
The train slowly eased to a halt in a cloud of steam. Bruin Bear and the Seagoat jumped off and hurried forward. The humans got off more slowly, secretly glad for a chance to stretch their legs and ease aching posteriors. The bear signaled for them to stay where they were while he and the goat examined the damage. Bruin Bear leaned over the dug-up tracks and studied them thoughtfully.
Not too close, Bear. I've got a bad feeling about this.
Oh, you've always got a bad feeling about things.
Suddenly, a cloth hand burst up out of the broken earth and fastened around his ankle. Bruin Bear cried out in shock and alarm and then toppled over backwards. He tried to scramble away, and the owner of the hand came rising up out of the pit it had dug under the tracks, squirming out of the loose earth like a maggot from an apple. It was a rag doll, stitched together from hundreds of different colored patches, but there was metal in it too, great steel staples holding it together like some ragged Frankenstein creature. Its cloth face crumpled with rage and hatred as it looked across at the humans by the train. And then its mouth stretched wide, stitches tearing apart, and it screamed. There was enough human emotion in the artificial voice, a horrid, implacable howl of fury and eternal enmity, to chill the soul. Bruin Bear kicked his foot as hard as he could, but couldn't break free. The ragdoll pulled itself over him as he struggled and raised a cloth hand holding a long machete. The doll snarled at the bear and then swung the machete down with savage speed. It was only a few inches from Bear's head when the energy bolt from the disruptor tore the cloth arm away from its body and sent the burning arm flying through the air, still clutching its machete. The Seagoat stuffed the gun back inside his trench coat and hurried forward. The bear and the doll were still struggling furiously. Bruin Bear rolled over suddenly, pulling the doll beneath him, and sharp metal claws erupted from his paws. He tore into the ragdoll with vicious strength, and shreds of cloth flew through the air. The goat had almost reached them when the earth under the broken tracks boiled and seethed, and a dozen more ragdolls came clawing up out of the ground, like the undead from their graves.
Don't just stand there!
Edwin the Train cried to the stunt humans.
Do something! Help them!
Finley started forward with his sword in his hand.
What the hell? Anyone who hates Bruin Bear has to be one of the bad guys.
The others moved quickly after him, and soon a battle was raging furiously around the dug-up tracks. The ragdolls were incredibly strong and unbelievably limber, their limbs and bodies bending at impossible angles as they launched their attacks. They all had swords and machetes of some kind, the jagged blades crusted with old, dried blood. The rebel swords cut deep into the cloth bodies, but did no harm. Julian stabbed one where its heart should have been, and the doll just snarled at him, pulling itself along the blade to get at him. Julian wondered where the hell he could hit the damn thing and do some damage. Finley and Evangeline fought back to back. Evangeline's skill with the sword was strictly limited, but Finley's speed and skill were enough to keep the dolls at arm's length while she guarded his back. She cut and hacked doggedly and tried to keep her horror to herself as the dolls just kept coming back for more. Finley gutted one doll with a savage sideways sweep and was surprised to see dark fluids that might have been blood oozing from the tear in its rag stomach. The doll screamed furiously and fought on as strong as before. Giles Deathstalker opened up a wide space around him, his great strength and long sword picking up the rag dolls and throwing them aside. Still, he wasn't doing any real damage, or even slowing them down much. He was facing an enemy that refused to lie down and die, and a slow chill went through him as he realized he didn't know what to do to stop them. Toby and Flynn stayed well back, getting it all on film.
Go for the heads!
Toby yelled above the roar of battle cries and screaming dolls.
They must have some kind of control mechanisms. Go for them!
Finley beheaded one of the dolls. The head went bouncing away across the grass, still grimacing, and the body just went on fighting.
Of course, since these are automatons, there's no guarantee their brains are located in their heads.
The human fighters were slowly being forced back together in a tight knot, fighting off their ragged opponents with desperate strength. No matter what damage they took, the dolls just kept pressing forward. Bruin Bear and the Sea Goat fought to get back and help the humans, but other dolls held them at bay. Finally, Julian Skye threw aside his sword and fired up his mind. A doll's machete streaked for his throat, and then suddenly all the dolls were thrown backwards by a wave of pure psionic energy erupting out of the young Esper. The Psystorm swept the ragdolls away like straws in a hurricane, tearing them to pieces.